I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Across the country, August has been a disastrous month.
And if you live in Haywood County, there is a state of emergency that's been declared. So we have Transylvania County and now Haywood County under a state of emergency.
At least 10 people are dead and 31 are still missing after torrential flooding in Middle Tennessee.
Right now, there are 12 large wildfires burning across California.
These weather events have killed dozens, displaced thousands, and destroyed millions in property. But even as we respond to these moments, it is imperative to ask, just what is disaster? Okay, listen, stick with me for a second, because I want us to challenge the unspoken assumptions at the root of how we tend to understand the very idea of disaster. Let's do it by asking some questions. What if we thought of weather events like floods, fires, and quakes, not as disasters, but as shocks? Somewhat unpredictable, these shocks focus our attention and allow us to see the real disasters, disasters that exist long before a storm gathers on the horizon. Now, this would allow us to define disaster as the deeply rooted social and structural problems that lead to unequal distribution of risk, vulnerability, and resources. It is these social problems which are truly disastrous. Okay, think of the winter storm that hit Texas earlier this year. That was a shock, and it revealed a real disaster, the state's inadequate power grid.
Texans are still reeling from the power outage crisis earlier this year.
All the suffering and the terrible experience that people have is heart-wrenching, and we never want this to happen again.
But many experts see what happened as a sign of things to come, and not just in Texas.
And if we think this way, how would it alter our ideas about preparedness, mitigation, response, recovery? If disasters are social, structural, and long-term, then we're going to need more than bottled water and batteries to prepare and rebuilding the bonds of civic trust. Knowing our neighbors, investing in reliable public transportation and modern infrastructure, well, these may be much better disaster mitigation strategies than even the very best packed go bag. For more, I'm joined now by Chauncia Willis, co-founder and CEO of the Institute for Diversity and Inclusion in Emergency Management, who has been a certified emergency manager for more than 20 years. Chauncia, welcome.
Thank you. How are you doing?
Well, good. I can't wait to dig into this. And we're going to be joined also here by Jacob Remus, a clinical associate professor at NYU, where he focuses on urban disasters, working class organizations, and migration. He's also the director of the Initiative for Critical Disaster Studies. Jacob, welcome.
Thanks very much.
So I have to say, Jacob, in the fall of 2020, I did teach a course on disaster race in American politics. I put both of you all on my syllabus. And Jacob, let me start with you. Talk a little bit about how inequities impact the things that we typically define as a disaster.
Well, inequity builds in disaster in several ways, kind of before, during, and after. So if you think about before, the questions you can ask are, why do some people live in places that are going to flood or that are likely to burn down? And we know in this country that people of color are much more likely to live in areas prone to flooding. We know that people with less money are more likely to live in places that are likely to be hit by tornadoes. And then there's questions about during the event or during the disaster, people whose houses are less likely to stand up to the hazard, to the flood, to the earthquake, to the tornado. We can, again, see how the inequities in American society and in societies around the world get built into, literally built into the structures where we live and work. And then there's access to resources after the disaster, who can pressure their representatives for more aid, who has access to more informal aid, who can go to their friends, neighbors, whose relatives are more likely to have extra guest rooms if your house gets destroyed. Obviously, We know that the people who have more money, that their friends and relatives are also more likely to have more money and therefore more likely to have space and more likely to have help to aid people. So in all of these ways, all of the inequalities and inequities in our society, and then that's replicated on a global scale also, get built into how we experience disaster.
I so appreciate the sort of walking us through that, the before, the during, and the after, right? The mitigation and the response and the recovery. So, Chauncey, I'm interested here because your background is in emergency management, and I've always kind of preferred the word emergency to disaster for exactly the reasons that I was kind of starting with. But talk to me about in that work around emergency management, what you have seen as gaps or voids.
Emergency management has typically been about doing the most for the most. And when we do the most for the most, we leave out those who are most vulnerable. Unfortunately, America, like many countries around the world, has a problem. And that problem bleeds over into emergency management, into all phases of emergency management. And we see that it becomes evident during times of disaster. And really, it's discrimination in all of its ugly forms. It's anti-poverty prejudice. It's structural racism. Our country is really built on systems. And those systems, particularly the racial hierarchy, undergirds every aspect of our society, and it influences the policies and practices that have been created to uphold that system. So emergency management, it began as civil defense. The entire foundation really has a lot of elements of assumptions about who is a priority and who is not, who can be considered an acceptable loss, and who needs to recover after a disaster.
Help me understand what doing the most for the most means. Put that down where the goats can get it for me. Help me understand what that means if you're actually like doing the work of emergency management in that moment.
In that moment, you're giving everything you have towards an equality-based approach. So what that means is if you are going into a site, and many times as an emergency manager, I've been deployed to different locations. And so we're taught to give everyone the same thing, throw as many resources at that flood or tornado or hurricane. And in the recovery process, we want to make sure that if we're providing individual assistance to those impacted groups, we give everyone the same amount. We do the same thing for everyone, whether they need it or whether or not they really don't need it and they could do without. So if you think about a flood situation where one family might have flood insurance, the other one may not, we know that essentially if they both apply, they'll get pretty much the same amount. And one family might need $4,000, one family might only need $100. But we come in and we say, we want to do the most for the most people. We want to make sure that the majority of people receive assistance. And what happens is those who are most vulnerable, those who may not be able to fill out the applications properly, those who represent lower income, historically marginalized groups, immigrants and other groups, those are considered acceptable losses. So they fall into the gap.
I got it. That makes sense to me. So if there's already a pre-existing inequality, then you have an emergency, and then you give everyone equally, which sounds fair, right? Everybody gets a sandwich. But if I started out with two sandwiches and I lost one, I may only need one more to be made whole. If I started out with only one sandwich and I lost that one, right, I might need two to be made whole. So it's helpful to see how what feels like a fair decision, give everyone the same thing, could actually reproduce an inequity. And Jacob, I want to come to you on that because consistently in living through disasters, whether it was after the levee failure in New Orleans, after Hurricane Katrina, whether it's been what we've seen in Houston, after the ice storms, so frequently during the reporting, during the emergency, you'll hear things like, This is our opportunity to rebuild in a completely different way, right? To do something that is more equitable. But so often, if you come back 5, 10, 15 years later, the inequities actually got reproduced. Why do you think that is?
I think that's a really good question, and one that I grapple with a lot because, as you say, in the immediate aftermath, there's often this conversation about doing better, being more equitable. And there's often moves to that because in the immediate aftermath of disaster, you often see the survivors organizing and developing new types of politics and building a kind of what previous scholars have called a democracy of sufferers. But as you say, then that very rarely carries forward. And I think a lot of it is built into the idea of disaster or built into the idea of emergency, that what you want to do, built into the idea of disaster or recovery, is that we should be going back to whatever existed before. The goal of disaster response very often is to restore the status quo ante, which is to say, whatever the conditions were that produced the disaster to begin with, let's go back to that. We want to, there was a shock. We've got to go back to what it was the day before the storm. And of course, what that means is it's great for the people who had good lives before the storm because they get to go back to having their good life. If what you had before the storm was already a crisis of affordable housing or a crisis of environmental racism, then going back to what existed the day before the storm isn't so great. In fact, it's just setting us up for the next disaster. And so I think built into the very idea that disasters are unusual, that they are times from which to recover, gets us to that problem that we are recovering back to whatever it was that created the disaster to begin with. You really see that in the phrase to restore order, right? This is one of the very first things that we hear about. And obviously restoring order usually is done by armed men who bring violence, which is to say the police. But even the phrase restoring order, well, the order that you're restoring benefited some people, harmed others. That's manifestly true, even if you support the order. So restoring order becomes this political decision. Well, let's go back to the system that benefited some and harmed others.
Chauncey, I want to come back to something that Jacob said earlier, where he suggested, you know, why do folks live, we need to understand the inequities built in sort of our vulnerability, our kind of residential vulnerability. But I got to say, these days, it feels like everybody lives in a floodplain, that with climate change, there are none of us that can build our, you know, houses on a hill high enough to be away from the possibility of critical weather events. Talk to me about continuing inequities within the context of climate change.
That's a great question. So we're essentially in the midst of a climate crisis, and there's an urgency of now. And the climate crisis that we are experiencing impacts us every day in several ways, whether it's increased temperatures, heat waves, more frequent and larger and more intense and more impactful hurricanes, wildfires, even pandemics. Those who are most vulnerable to risk will be most impacted by this ongoing climate crisis. And we know that eventually those who are in positions of authority now, as we've seen with the last census, may soon become a part of those who are experiencing the climate crisis and are being deemed more vulnerable. So our world today really is changing, and we're all going to be experiencing some form of disaster. Eventually, I believe we're going to start seeing global resource shortages. And with scarcity comes an added layer of vulnerability. So, you know, I think right now we have to focus on equity. Equity is the word of the day, and diversity, equity, and inclusion will allow us to effectively manage the multitude of disasters that are occurring every day, but that are coming. And we just have to be realistic about that.
So, Jacob, I want to build on that insight around an inclusive and equitable way of preparing and mitigating, and also go back to your insight around a community of sufferers. And I'm wondering that even as we may be pushing for structural change in the way that emergency management happens, are there other ways that we can begin to maybe rethink what disaster preparedness looks like in our own communities? So instead of, I mean, we're going to talk a little later in the show about actually like household preparedness, but are there ways that whole communities can prepare, like knowing our neighbors and figuring out whether or not the elderly on our block or in our building have a way out? Like, what are the things that we can start doing now that can build those more equitable approaches?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I would say that the only way we can prepare for disaster is with other people, because disaster is necessarily a social event. So my NYU colleague, Eric Kleinenberg, years ago wrote a really important book about the Chicago heat wave of 1996, where he found that not only so the people who die in heat waves, of which there are more and more each year, not only are those people who die, elderly, isolated people, but that it's not just built into the individuals, that it's built into the neighborhoods, and it's built into the lives that people have lived. And so the way that masculinity and white supremacy work in this country is that older Black men are more likely to be socially isolated and therefore at risk of death in heat waves than other similar people. And that in neighborhoods in which there is little street life, aren't many stores, the housing stock is falling apart, there's high crime, so elderly people are afraid to leave the house, or there's perception of high crime. Those are places where people are much more likely to die from heat waves than bustling neighborhoods, places where there's street life, places where there's an active civil society, where there are stores where people can go, where there's less crime and people are less afraid. And so the way we need to be preparing for the ever-increasing extreme weather events that will come with climate change is to build those communities that happily we want to live in, even if the heat wave never comes, right? We all want to live in a neighborhood that is safer, that is more bustling, that has more to do, that has closer and tighter social connections. And that's also what protects us in disasters. So you talk about building, going and checking on your elderly neighbors, and that's certainly true. But I would say it's even more than that. It's building the organizations and the communities so that people aren't isolated to begin with. So in my life, that means organizing a union. That means being part of political movements. It means talking to one's neighbors and building relationships with one's neighbors a year, 2 years, 3 years before the hurricane watch.
Chauncey, I'm wondering, as you work with policymakers, with other folks who are tasked with emergency management, if some of what we're hearing from Jacob here, this like long-term planning, which is really about community building and people power building, is there a way to infuse into policymaker training that kind of insight?
Well, sure. You know, as an emergency manager, we've been doing long-term planning for a long time, and the communal approach to preparedness has always been seen as a strength. And for those emergency managers that have the influence, their leaders, their senior officials of their jurisdiction, it is important to focus on communal preparedness and to focus on cultural competence and understand that it really does take a village to be resilient.
Chauncey Willis is co-founder and CEO of the Institute for Diversity and Inclusion in Emergency Management. And Jacob Remus is a clinical associate professor at NYU. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.